This ad-free podcast is part of your Slate Plus membership.
Hello! Welcome to Money Talks from Slate Money. This is a very, very special episode of Money Talks because I only do this once every 5 years. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, and I have had various affiliations over the years, but the one thing that is a constant since the beginning of the age of Bitcoin is that every 5 years I get into a bet with Ben Horowitz. Ben Horowitz, welcome.
Thank you, Felix. It's good to be back after 5 years.
Ben, you are, well, tell me, who are you? Introduce yourself.
I am one of the founding partners of Andreessen Horowitz, who are, I think we have the largest crypto fund in the world. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah.
This other gentleman who's just jumped in here is Chris Dixon. Welcome.
Hi, Felix. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Chris, what's your role in the cryptoverse? And plug your book.
So I'm Ben's partner. I've worked with Ben for about 10 years, and I created our separate crypto fund that we started about 5 years ago. And I just published a book. Thank you for mentioning that. It's called Read, Write, Own. It's about blockchains and kind of my view that they're a useful tool for building new internet services that have a lot of benefits of kind of the early internet and decentralized networks like email and the web, but also can power advanced services that we're kind of accustomed to today.
Okay, we're going to talk a lot of crypto and blockchain, but first of all, we're going to settle a bet. And it's all coming up on Money Talks. Okay, so Ben, remind me, what have we been betting about all of these years?
Well, we've been betting about basically the usage of crypto and payments for consumers, which has probably not been a good idea for me.
So the first bet that we entered into 10 years ago was whether 10% of Americans would be using Bitcoin to pay for something. We visited that 5 years later, which is 5 years ago, and it turned out they weren't. But you weren't ready to give up at that point. So we re-entered the bet. And this time we didn't say Bitcoin in particular. We said crypto in general. And we didn't say the United States. We said Mexico, which was your choice. And you said you believed that by now, 10% of Mexicans would be using crypto to pay for something. In hindsight, was this a smart bet to go into with me?
The big mistake in the bet from my standpoint was that the use case of payments ends up being what we kind of call skeuomorphic in kind of computer science world, which means it's kind of a direct kind of metaphor for the technology onto something that, you know, sort of already exists in the regular world, as opposed to a new use case. And that's probably the biggest whoops in the bet. Otherwise, you know, crypto has kind of developed quite nicely, and there's, you know, it's getting much, much faster and much more interesting over time. But that bet is turning out bad for me. What did we bet this time? Last time we bet some socks, which was an easy thing for me to pay. I think we bet something more expensive this time.
Yeah, the first time around, we bet a pair of alpaca socks, and you were very, very sweet and sent me not one, but two pairs of alpaca socks, which I have to this day and are very warm and cozy. The stakes this time were a little bit more complicated. It was one ETH. And
wow,
also,
like that's worth a lot, yeah.
Which last time I looked, I think that's worth like $2,500. I don't know if I'm allowed to
accept. It's like $3,000 now, yeah.
$3,000 from venture capitalists. This might have to make its way to the Committee to Protect Journalists. So it was one ETH, but also a 100-year-old bottle of Madeira. Oh. I'm not quite sure how I managed to come up with that.
How do I get that?
Well, you're a resourceful man, Ben. I'm sure you can manage to do this somehow.
I'm partial to 100 years old.
100 years old. I'm partial to the Cerciel myself, but you can do any 100-year-old bottle of Madeira. My idea was that Madeira, being something that has been around for 100 years, is something that is much more likely to hold its value than cryptocurrencies that go up and down all over the place. And as it happens, just like 5 years ago, here we are 5 years later, the cryptocurrencies have gone up rather than down in value, which is actually one of the reasons. And the value of a bottle of Madeira has gone pretty much sideways, as I expected. Like, something that's been around for 100 years doesn't tend to be very volatile. So, but the very fact that ETH and Bitcoin and all of these popular cryptocurrencies has gone up in value is a reason why people don't want to spend them on stuff. I mean, this is the main reason why it isn't working as payments, right?
I think that's not, I think in the case of Bitcoin, that's probably true in that it is, I mean, the volatility and then the fact that they keep appreciating, you know, it, there are so many stories of people buying a pizza for $3 million or what would be $3 million a day or something like that. And of course, the dollar hasn't performed like super well from a purchasing power standpoint. So you'd much rather spend that. But I think that also, you know, payments is something that works reasonably well in the current system, you know, as opposed to some of the other things. And Chris will talk about this a little bit. But if you look at, for example, the take rate on payments, well, some might consider egregious, you know, whatever, 2-3% on a credit card, and you get fraud protection and so forth, and these kinds of things for that cost is nothing compared to like the 30% take rate of the App Store, you know, from Apple, or the 99% take rate from Instagram for the content that you post there, and these kinds of things. So it turns out that the more interesting or the more valuable uses of the technology end up being in other domains. I think there's something to that, but I think that also payments has just turned out to be the wrong application.
Yeah, payments is pretty advanced in most countries. It's funny, I did do a bit of homework for this in terms of trying to work out what the actual number was, the percentage of Mexicans using crypto. There's one big electronics chain called Electra, which is run by the Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. And he famously is a, you know, laser-eyed Bitcoin bull. And he was like, we will accept crypto for payments for all of our electronics. And I phoned up Electra and I'm like, well, has anyone actually done this and come in and paid with Bitcoin? And they kind of ghosted me. Interestingly, the one use case I did manage to find was American expats who find it quite hard to navigate the Mexican bureaucracy and open a bank account when they need to pay not so much rent, but like something like a gym membership or something like that. And the gym is like, well, just transfer money from your bank account. And they're like, I don't have a bank account. The gym will be like, well, just pay us in crypto then. So it's like where the main system kind of fails because of difficulty with bank account transfers, then you can find it a little bit. That's the payment side of things. So I'm assuming from what you're saying that having kind of lost this bet twice, you're not willing to enter into it a third time. You've kind of realized that crypto is not really cryptocurrency in the as is most people understand currency.
Yeah, well, I think that cryptocurrency is the worst name that we could have come up with for the technology. it's, you know, to the normal person, it means secret money. And of course, the crypto in this case isn't used for secrecy and it's not really money the way you think about money.
You know? Oh, you mean it's like crypto as in crypto fascist?
Oh, no. It's crypto as in crypto authentication.
Right. But in terms of how people receive it, it's like, it's not a great sort of sales name.
Yeah, it sounds like something very devious, which it's not. Yeah, no, I think that it'd be great to have a different bet around crypto, but I think the payments bet, I'm going to defer to Chris for advice on this because he's my crypto advisor who knows much more than I do.
Chris, were you aware of these bets? Were you like silently?
I think I saw some on Twitter. Yeah.
Were you silently screaming, going, Ben, what are you doing? This isn't a payments name.
Well, I probably made the same mistake at least 10 years ago. I mean, but, you know, as you know, Felix, like I think part of it is there's a whole backstory, which I won't go into all the detail, but the Bitcoin community probably about 6 or 7 years ago really kind of moved more to the store of value use case. There was a kind of civil war in the Bitcoin community between the what was called the block size debate, which is essentially a technical change that would have made Bitcoin friendlier to payments, and that was rejected by the community. I think what you both were saying about, you know, the limits of Bitcoin as a payment system is true, but I also think that the community really kind of leaned into the store of value use case instead. And I do think, although payments are not my favorite use case for crypto, I do think there have been signs of life around stablecoins. You know, if you look at the data put out by, like, for example, Circle, which is a firm that builds software for stablecoins, we're not investors, but they seem to be, you know, doing quite well. They, you know, the latest stats I saw were $700 billion in stablecoin transactions last month. And so I think that's growing. I think that's probably less payments and more people in the developing world getting access to dollars, is my suspicion. I don't think there's great data on that. It tends to correlate to countries where there's high currency volatility, like Argentina as an example. So I think it potentially is maybe, you know, and as that grows, I hear stories anecdotally, I don't have data, of firms using kind of in B2B use cases, kind of a business paying another business in a developing country using dollars, using stable coins. So I do think that could be kind of sneak up on us as a interesting use case. There's a bill pending in Congress called the stablecoin bill, which would, I think, put good kind of additional regulatory guardrails around stablecoins.
Back when stablecoins were first coming onto the scene, you could keep your dollars in Tether or USDC when it was launched, and the opportunity cost of doing that was pretty low. Now we have interest rates of 5%, and if I just keep my cash in dollars, I can earn 5% on that. If I keep my cash in a stablecoin, I earn 0% on that. You know, that's a large penalty for me to pay for whatever advantage I get from being in on a blockchain, right?
Well, I'm just looking now, like Coinbase is offering 5.1% on USDC. So they pass most of the, I think they do take some portion for their business model. I think generally, at least with USDC, they've been sort of, you know, roughly matching the interest rates.
Okay, but then that's a little bit different, right? That's where I open up an account with, where I lend my money to Coinbase and then they pay me interest. So then I'm taking Coinbase credit risk as well.
Yeah, I think maybe there's nuances because there's a consortium that holds USDC and I'm not an expert on it, but I believe legally it's, you know, you're actually taking whatever bank, they use a major US bank. It's more of a custody relationship than a credit relationship is my understanding, but I'm not an expert on that. But that would be the kind of thing that a good stablecoin bill would clarify, right?
Because yeah, obviously, you know, if you're earning interest on anything, it's some kind of a loan. You're lending the money to the US government or
yeah. I mean, ideally it's the same risk as lending to a bank. And the additional benefit of a stablecoin is it's now, you know, it's fully digital money. And that means, as Ben was alluding to, we kind of think of technology as applying to kind of doing old things better and doing new things you couldn't do before. So old things better would be, you know, payments, maybe at a lower fee or something. I think that's less interesting personally. And this is, by the way, me speaking generally on technology. I think for AI and other areas, it's the new things you couldn't do before that are, to me, the most interesting. And so as an example, net by creating a stablecoin, you can now have programmable money. You can write software that moves the money around. And so you can do things like, you could imagine a system where AI systems are using artists' training data and making money off of it. The people are designing systems where those AI systems pay out the creators who contribute to the training data, as an example. And that's something that's, you know, if you have purely digital kind of micropayment programmable money, you can design new systems that you couldn't design before. And just, you know, from my perspective as an investor, those kind of new futuristic use cases are more interesting and exciting. And just from a competitive point of view, you're not trying to compete with an existing pretty well-designed payment system that we have. You're just doing something new that can't be done currently.
Yeah. And I remember hearing this very frequently during the boom times of NFTs in 2021. And everyone was like, well, this is something you can do with crypto that is really hard to do with anyone else, which is have resale royalties built into the contract so that anytime, you know, if you create a work of art and then sell it, then anytime the person who buys it resells it, you'll get a cut of that resale. And everyone got really excited about this because it was like a whole new income stream for artists that had never existed before. And then, you know, after a year or 18 months or something, suddenly all of those resale, like people just started selling the NFTs without paying the resale royalties, and the artists found out there was nothing they could do about it. Like, these things aren't quite as baked into the blockchain as people had been given to believe.
Yeah, that's right. Although I will say there's now, I mean, you're getting into a nuanced technical issue. There's a counter movement. So there's people that have now designed systems that force you to do the creator royalties. There was basically a loophole and people worked around the loophole, and now people have closed the loophole and new systems. So, but yes, it is complicated. Specifically with NFTs, I just think, you know, a couple things I'll just say quickly is that, first of all, that was a technology that was the standard was created in 2020. So it's very young, number one. And number two, even after the kind of downturn last year, there were over 8 billion in NFT sales. So it's, you know, it's down from the year before, but still, you know, significant scale for a 4-year-old technology. And I also think, you know, I talk about this a lot in my book. I think of NFTs as a very general technology. It's a way to represent digital ownership that can be something like an avatar picture, which is what people associate with NFTs, or a piece of art, but it can be anything, including, like, there's a really interesting wave of new social networks where the NFT represents your identity. Like, so I'm C. Dixon on Twitter and I have followers on Twitter, and the NFT represents my audience. And why is that interesting? Because it lets the user switch from one software provider to another. So if you're unhappy with the algorithm and the social media platform, you can take your audience and move in the same way that you can with, for example, an email newsletter service. Like, you know, if you're on Substack and you don't like Substack, you can leave and take your audience with you. So just to give you a flavor for it, like, NFTs are a very general technology, and sort of I think of them as a technical building block where you can build new internet services that have different properties and sort of shift power to users and creators and developers and people that use the network. So I think we're just, you know, we're 4 years into it and we're kind of just beginning to scratch the surface of what you can do with this, with these new ideas.
So Ben, this is something that, you know, you and I have talked about quite a lot over the years. It's this idea of crypto and blockchain is the new internet, and whatever amazing revolutionary change was caused by the internet would also be caused by crypto on a similar time horizon. But, you know, Bitcoin was invented in 2008 as a response to the financial crisis. We are quite a ways in from that at this point. We're, you know, 15 years in. It's hard for me to think of anything big and revolutionary that crypto has done. At what point do you kind of start thinking to yourself?
Well,
you
know, I think that's not quite fair in that, right? TCP/IP was invented in 1973. And in 1988, I think you might have said the same thing about the internet, although there was very, very kind of interesting infrastructure built. Most people didn't know what the internet was. Actually, much fewer people than know what crypto is.
That's true.
And I think Chris actually wrote about it very succinctly, where, you know, it can be also thought of as the third wave of the internet, where it fixes a lot of the issues. So in the 1.0 internet, we had a kind of great society in that it was very open and egalitarian and anybody could participate. And there weren't these huge taxes by the monopoly companies and there weren't these massive concentrations of power, but it lacked functionality to do things like social networking and search and some of these, you know, some of the other kinds of modern features of the internet. And then that functionality has been put in place by blockchain and crypto. You know, look, it is, you know, and Chris can talk about some of the many examples, but it is like the fact that it's working, it's such a technological breakthrough, and that it works technically is amazing. And then there's quite a few use cases and applications and so forth. And it's not, you know, taken over yet. But again, these infrastructure things are hard. And, you know, performance in the last year is probably up like close to 100-fold. If you think about the performance and that you get with layer two, and then the cost reduction that you get. So as these things get cheaper and better, they get much more popular. I mean, the internet before we had a lot of bandwidth was only interesting to computer scientists. And I think that was certainly the case 15 years in.
So, like, Ethereum is, you know, oversimplifying massively because I don't really understand these things, it's a big sort of virtual computer which you can run programs on. And you're saying that basically the cost of compute has come down 100-fold on that computer, that it's easier to run programs on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would argue, Felix. I mean, I think that there's truth in what you're saying, and that things were, you know, some things were overhyped, especially in the last, you know, the cycle run up, as
always the case in technology.
Yeah. And I would argue now it's sort of a microcosm of the .com thing. Like, you had the .com bubble and then you had the crash, and that was when I started my career, really. And it was just, you know, consensus that, I mean, the internet was growing, but it was consensus that it wasn't like a great place to do business and that it was overhyped as a business. You know, I started an AI company in 2008, and AI first neural network paper was 1943. In 2008, you got a lot of eye rolls when you said AI. In fact, we said machine learning, not AI, because AI had sort of was associated with, there was actually an AI, for those who don't know, there was an AI bubble in the 80s, believe it or not. You can go look up. There's expert systems. There was a financial bubble. Like, I grant you that it was, that things have been overhyped, and in the sense of like the time frame.
Like, in the immediate term, you have these very interesting use cases that are popping up. So once you have AI, there's a few things that become real challenges, like who's human and who's not. And there's a really interesting new crypto company that does proof of humanity, where they scan your retina and create a private key that, and you can do basically a zero knowledge proof once you have that shows you're human. So you can tell people that you're human without revealing your identity.
Is this the WorldCoin people with the orb?
Yes. Yes, exactly. The orb.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, talk about dystopian visions. I mean, they're taking this orb around the world and putting it into people's eyeballs. And you're like, yeah, this is great. This is all perfect.
Apple's doing it too. Just you don't think of it that way. But like, every time you scan your face.
Exactly. Much better if you can do it without an orb. I'm just going to come out and say that.
Well, but, you know, if you want to preserve anonymity, then you need the orb. Because you're definitely not doing that with your iPhone. But, you know, kind of more, you know, proximate is you have this issue of deep fakes and what's real and what's not. And, you know, particularly if you're a public figure, if you're Felix Salmon, if you're Joe Biden, you know, somebody, you'd like to be able to say, look, I did this speech or I did this podcast and this is really me and I'm going to sign it. And then you'd like the arbiter of the truth to not be Google or Meta or, you know, some gigantic corporation, and you'd probably like it not to be the US government either. And the right technology for that, you know, also ends up being kind of blockchain and crypto. So you have these ways of knowing what's true, knowing who's who, as well as kind of a technology to build the networks of the future. You know, we talk a lot in Silicon Valley about, oh, we need stakeholder capitalism. But there's no mechanic to get that, right? You know, like, you hear Benioff will talk, oh, we need stakeholder capitalism. But like, what do users of Salesforce get, really? They're stakeholders, but they don't really participate other than they have to pay, you know, Benioff a lot of money. And crypto is the architecture for stakeholder capitalism, where the people who use the product, the people who are participating in it, the creatives who add value to the network, all kind of participate economically in what's going on. And I think that, you know, moving forward, that's going to be increasingly important. And then, you know, as you move into applications like the metaverse, you know, in that world, you know, can I work? Can I get paid? Or does it just all go to like three corporations who run the metaverse and they take all the money and all your time, and you get nothing in return? And I think that's the dystopian world. So crypto is the thing that makes the future bright, in my view. And it's, you know, like, it's why we're so dogged about staying with it, because not just that, you know, like, we think it's a good investment and all that, but beyond that, you know, it's probably the most important mission in the firm is crypto and making sure that we get to a world where it's not just controlled, where there's not a massive concentration of power, because that generally doesn't end well for humans.
the biggest story in the stock market over the past few years has really been the way in which it has become dominated by a handful of massive tech companies. You look at the market capitalization of the S&P 500, and it's all Microsoft, Apple, Nvidia, Alphabet, Meta, Amazon. And that's, you know, like without them, it's gone nowhere. You've got, and so what you're basically saying, if I have you right, is that that's bad and crypto solves this. And that if crypto succeeds, then, you know, all of the millions of Americans who are currently invested in the S&P 500 are going to be quite sad because all of their like tech stocks are going to go down.
Well, those five may. and look, I think the market cap is sort of like a great expression of it. But, you know, the power is extremely dangerous in that, you know, it's complete information control. So, you know, what's going on in the world is decided by five companies. It's a huge tax on the system. I mean, the fact that you pay 30%, a 30% tax to Apple just for handing you an application is just absolutely incredible. And then, you know, for people who create value in the world, they're not rewarded proportionate to the value that they create. I mean, you can see this. I mean, this is the thing with the only way to make money, you know, on social is by being a porn star. Like at this point, it's crazy when, you know, people are creating, you know, amazing music, new dances, interesting things, and all the money goes to the corporation. The really difficult kind of economic environment, I think, for regular, you know, people who don't own giant corporations, who aren't executives at Google or Alphabet and these kinds of things. And so I think it's just like a really, really important thing in the world, you know, and we have the technology to facilitate it. And, you know, like, you know, we're furiously trying to build the new services that take advantage of this technology and kind of distribute the power and not have these like mega powerful corporations just not only controlling the stock market, but controlling life.
I would add to that too, that, you know, we're excited as a firm about AI and doing a lot of AI investing, but AI generally rewards companies with large pools of capital and data. And I think, you know, we'll see what happens with open source AI, but generally I think AI, as positive as it is overall, will lead to greater centralization. It's you're already seeing this happen where these companies with, you know, Google has more data than anybody and more capital, and Facebook just bought, what was it, 10,000 H100s from NVIDIA, $10 billion in CapEx. And so, you know, I think when I look around the landscape, it's like AI, metaverse, these are all kind of centralizing technologies, and the only credible counterbalance besides maybe regulation is blockchains and crypto.
So, but you're not just saying that it can be a countervailing force. You're saying that it will be a countervailing
force. Well, I hope so. I mean, like, we're predicting the future.
But this is your bet, right? This is the bet of the fund.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's right, yeah. And that would be a bet if Ben wants to make another bet on another 100-year-old bottle.
Ben, how would you construct a bet around that? Because I know you're a betting man.
Yeah, no, I would love to make a bet around that. What's the right formulation of the bet, Chris? I don't want to lose another bet because I don't know how to formulate it.
How about a blockchain-based service that's not speculative, that's used by, I don't know, 10 million, I'm making up a number, some significant, but not, you know, some significant number of users in 5 years. I don't know if it's 10 million or a higher number.
And so if I'm thinking about the most popular blockchain-based services that I can think of right now, would either be the ones that allow you to buy crypto or the ones that allow you to buy NFTs, which are similarly speculative. People are like, oh yeah, I want, you know, NBA top shots because they go up in value.
So for example, a social network, a collaborative, like I, you know, the stuff I'm discussing with AI-based, you know, services, authenticating you're really a human, fighting deepfakes, whatever it might be. Something that's not price going up.
And that people need to sort of sign on to and...
Yeah, on they some download level, like, a wallet or some kind of browser.
Like, actual usage, yeah.
Own
yeah.
Some kind of a token.
Yeah. And they would download... Like today, you download a wallet, which is like a wallet's like a browser for for this stuff, you know, some kind of, you download some software and you are a user and you're using it on a, I don't know if we want to say daily, weekly or monthly basis or whatever.
And presumably given where these bets have been going, you're, in terms of the total number of users and the potential number of users, we're thinking globally here, right? We're not thinking Americans.
I think it's a pretty global movement. So I think that would make sense, but.
Okay. So in 5 years time, we're going to have what, 9 billion people in the world, something like that.
I think there's 5 billion internet users. Probably, I assume that'll go up.
Okay. Let's say 6 billion internet users, conservative.
60 million. Is that 1%? Is that what you guys do with your bets?
Well, our last bets were 10%. That was the last bets, 10%. So like that would be, I mean, that one I would happily take if we took like 500 million users of something doing something non-speculative on a Bitcoin service.
How about 100 million? I'll propose a compromise.
100 million.
That's still a big number.
It is a big number. Okay, so basically there's an internet service that isn't speculative, the people aren't signing on to because they want to make money, but they're signing on to it because they get some other kind of utility out of it. And there are 100 million individuals who've like created a public key and have a wallet.
I think that'll be certainly much more interesting. So
I like it. So let's do that. And now we just need to come up with the state.
I have to find out how much that 100-year-old bottle is going to cost.
I can assure you it costs less than an ETH.
Okay. Yeah, no, it won't break me.
Yeah. It won't break Ben Horowitz. It won't be that much.
But one thing I could do is, so I have this charity event that I do. It's called the Paid in Full event, where we kind of honor and financially reward some of the early hip hop artists who never got their due and kind of never were kind of fairly compensated. And I could buy you a table at my event. I don't know what you would get me of equivalent value.
Okay. And then if I win, I will buy a table at the annual dinner for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
All right. All right. That sounds good.
Okay. We have a bet. It'll come up. Right. It'll come due in 2029, which is...
Hopefully we'll all be alive then.
Hopefully by that point, we won't have been turned into some kind of goo by an evil AI that has taken over the world.
Yeah. Yes.
So on that note, Ben Horowitz, Chris Dixon, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Felix.
It's great seeing you.
Thank you to Jared Downing and Shayna Roth for producing. And we'll be back on Saturday with a regular Slate Money.